clearly it is becoming the dominant variant in South Africa. The question for us here in the United States, now that it is clearly here in at least 15 or more states and in about 40 countries, is what is it going to be as it competes with a very dominant variant, Delta?
Dr. Anthony Fauci speaking on CNN yesterday, COVID cases here in the United States are climbing. For the first time in 2 months, the U.S. is averaging more than 100,000 new cases a day. Most of these infections are from the Delta variant. It is still too early to know how the recently discovered Omicron variant will impact COVID cases. Meanwhile, a surge of cases across Europe has rattled the continent. Last week, Austria began another lockdown, closing bars, restaurants, and theaters. Ireland has shut down nightclubs and restricted access to pubs. Belgium has closed schools early for the holiday break. Here to talk about all this is Kevin Whitelaw. He's the Brussels bureau chief for Bloomberg News. Hi there.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, you're in Brussels, and there were huge protests there over the weekend. Thousands of people, Belgian police used tear gas and water cannons on protesters. And then in Austria, more than 40,000 people protested. So what's going on?
Well, you know, you're definitely getting a combination of virus fatigue from just a bunch of people who were exhausted by the wave after wave after wave. But some of the specific protests are against some of the various measures, and they're different measures in different countries, but some of the different measures that have been taken to try to combat this latest wave, which really has seen Europe rack up some of the highest per capita case rates in the world right now. And so some countries are taking measures that are specifically targeting unvaccinated people, and that's obviously setting off a set of the population who tend to be in the anti-vaccine camp, something that obviously the U.S. is familiar with. In other cases, you're seeing protests like in Belgium against some of the other kinds of restrictions, you know, the COVID passes and some of the other closures that have been ordered or early closures that have been ordered in terms of nightclubs or restaurants or other kinds of establishments.
Well, what is driving this recent surge? Because more than 70% of the people in the EU have gotten at least one dose of the vaccine.
You know, it is a little puzzling at some point because, you know, I think that even in Belgium's a pretty good example. You've got a very highly vaccinated country, and some of the highest level outbreaks are in the most vaccinated part of Belgium, which is where you've got up to 93% of people over 18 who are vaccinated. That's in Flanders, the Dutch-speaking region of Belgium, and so it is complicated to understand that. In some cases, people have let their guard down, and some places had nearly had basically gotten rid of masking requirements, and people were socializing kind of the way they had been pre-pandemic. Some of that probably has come back to hurt people. In Belgium, some of what's happening is it's racing through the schools, and obviously in primary schools, you're seeing a lot of kids. Europe only just approved within the past week or two the vaccinations for kids, and they have not yet rolled them out in most countries. And so the population of 5 to 12-year-olds is entirely unvaccinated here. And you're seeing a lot of schools having to close, a lot of classrooms having to go into quarantine because they just have too many COVID cases. And that obviously then goes and spreads throughout the families. So some of these things are complicated dynamics as people understand that this Delta variant, which we still think is what has driven the current spikes, remains obviously something that can transmit through people, even who are vaccinated, even if obviously you're seeing hospitalization rates way, way, way below the worst of the earlier levels of the pandemic.
And I guess death rates as well.
And death rates as well. But what you are seeing is the hospitalization rates in a couple of countries, in Belgium, but Germany and elsewhere, are really getting pretty high just because you have so many cases that at some point there's going to be a certain number of them that are serious cases. Obviously, still tilts towards the unvaccinated, but there are some vaccinated people ending up in the hospital. And so there's a huge concern about capacity of the healthcare systems here to be able to deal with this if it gets any worse. I do think we've started to see a couple encouraging signs that maybe the peak is over and the rise may be slowing, but obviously that sort of comes just as we now are trying to understand what the Omicron variant might do to all of that.
Right. Well, talk about the different policies when it comes to lockdown. The EU is one place, and yet there are different policies in different countries. Germany has a lockdown. France does not.
Yeah, that's right. And the difference you have in a couple of these different countries is really based in part on where they're coming from. So there are countries like Austria and Germany that had really lower vaccination rates, and Italy as well to some degree. And they're really trying to figure out how to get those vaccination rates up before those hospitalization numbers really become entirely unmanageable. So you're seeing those countries really target measures toward the unvaccinated, really locking them out of a whole set of things. Starting today in Italy, if you want to take the bus or a train, if you want to go do almost anything, frankly, in the country, you need to be vaccinated. And in many cases, testing won't even do it. So Italy's put in some very, very tough measures. They're calling it essentially a lockdown for the unvaccinated. In other countries, Belgium and Netherlands and a few other places, they've really resisted doing that, in part because the country already is reasonably highly vaccinated. So they're working at trying to figure out how do you reduce some of those social contacts in ways that don't entirely disrupt people's lives and disrupt the economy. So you're seeing different levels of closures, whether it's closing nightclubs like you've seen in Belgium, and France just announced tonight, about an hour ago, that that's what they're going to do, is close the nightclubs. While in places like the Netherlands, they're actually closing restaurants and all kinds of other cultural and public establishments at 5 p.m. For a couple of weeks as they try to figure out how to wrestle with the spike. So it's really a huge variation in approaches, but you know, the overall aim is to get people vaccinated and to reduce a little bit of the sort of, you know, just get a little more social distancing back into people's lives.
I know that the State Department here is advising against traveling to the Czech Republic, for example, and a few other hotspots. What about Europe in general? Is it considered unsafe to travel there?
Well, I'm there. It doesn't feel wildly unsafe. I mean, you know, I think, you know, I was in the U.S. until this past summer. And so I, you know, sort of got pretty used to the levels of virus that I think Americans got comfortable with in a lot of different places. Came to Europe, it was much lower for a while. Now the numbers are much higher, but you're still looking at obviously a severity that's just not quite the same as the worst of the pandemic. And so, you know, I think the people are here pretty much still going about their lives. The Christmas markets in Brussels were, you know, they weren't jammed, but they were busy. There were people down there. These are outdoor markets and stalls throughout the downtown area. People are going out and doing things, trying to do more things outdoors. You are seeing, you know, the numbers in the restaurants maybe go down a little bit. It's a little cold to sit outside here, a little wet. So you're definitely seeing people modifying their behaviors on the margins, but you know, people are still going about, people are still doing things, they're still traveling, whether it's for vacation or work, but people are probably, you know, taking a few second thoughts about some of the activities and weighing it a little bit more, you know. But I do think that you are seeing an emphasis here in trying to keep the, you know, the schools open, and that's become a huge debate in Belgium as I said, the numbers are really mm-hmm. getting complicated in the schools with a number yeah. of primary schools having to shut down because there's simply too many COVID cases.
Well, I'm sure the kids are okay with that, an early holiday. Kevin Whitelaw, Brussels bureau chief for Bloomberg News. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up, would prosecuting parents for not locking up their guns put a dent in school shootings? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Last Tuesday, another horrific school shooting, this time just outside Detroit. 4 high school students were killed in that shooting. and school shootings have become tragically routine. What makes this case different from the others, the parents of the alleged shooter have been charged with involuntary manslaughter. Both have pleaded not guilty. We're going to talk about the legal consequences they face with Jessica Levinson. She's a professor at Loyola Law School and Press Play's regular Legal. Hello.
Hello. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. So as we mentioned, it is rare for parents of an alleged school shooter to face any kind of charge. Why did the prosecutor in this case decide to file charges?
Really rare. And I think the thing that's important for people to know is not just because these are parents who knew that they had maybe a troubled son, because these are parents who did a lot more than that. They helped him buy the gun. They knew that he was looking for ammunition. In fact, there's this text message that where the mother says, basically, I know you were looking for ammo, LOL, I'm not angry, just don't get caught next time. That they were actually called into school to talk about troubling drawings about shooting people that he had made, that they didn't check his backpack when they were at the school. They were told at the school, he needs counseling and you should take him home. And they refused to do so. So why are they being charged? Again, not because they are just parents who knew they had a troubled teen, because they took a lot of specific actions and frankly failed to take a lot of specific actions in this case.
Right. But in this case, Michigan does not have a law, a safe storage law that would require them to lock up their guns.
Exactly. So they're not being charged under a non-existent state safe storage law that a lot of other states do have. They're being charged here instead for involuntary manslaughter, which essentially is an unintentional killing. And what the prosecutors are going to have to do here is show that based on their awareness, based on what was reasonably foreseeable, that they basically acted in a way that was grossly negligent and that they allowed all of these circumstances to occur, that they should have known that there was a high degree of risk of either great bodily injury or death, again, based on everything they did and failed to do.
Hmm. Well, I wonder, they did look like they were fugitives for a while over the weekend. Do you think that that is going to play into the case, that they kind of look guilty by running? Will that play into this at all, or is that something separate?
Absolutely. I think that the prosecutors will try and use that as consciousness of guilt in this case. And the prosecutors will try and say, look, innocent people don't try and flee. Now, we've already heard what their defense is, which is, well, they feared for their safety. They were going to turn themselves in. I will say, looking at the facts, that they were found in a warehouse in Detroit with apparently no particular plan of turning themselves in and had withdrawn $4,000 from an ATM, maybe doesn't give their defense the best argument here. But yes, prosecutors will use that. There's a lot, as we've learned, that prosecutors are not allowed to use when it comes to trying to show that somebody was predisposed to commit a crime or might be liable. But this, the prosecutors, I believe, will use.
What do you think this will do in a bigger picture for the rest of the country, perhaps? Do you think that this would act as a deterrent in a way, and that parents who have guns in the house will now think, oh my gosh, I've got to take this more seriously, or I've got to make sure they're locked up, or what have you?
I think that's frankly the hope by the prosecutors and by a lot of people who obviously want to prevent these. I mean, it was so gutting that you said these tragedies are routine, because that's exactly true. They are. Mm-hmm. So yes, the prosecutors, I do think, want to reasonably make an example and not go beyond what the law allows, but use the law to say that this will not be permitted in this case. That Michigan, of course, they don't have a safe storage law. Mm-hmm. Now, 30 states and DC do, but those laws, while studies indicate that they could greatly help to reduce these school shootings, typically they have pretty weak penalties and weak enforcement mechanisms. So we might, yes, see more prosecutors saying, if the facts fit, you know, again, if parents take and or fail to take all of the actions that we see here, then you could be trying to draw that line between what the child does and what the parents might be liable for. But again, this is not based on some, you know, new theory of parent-child relationships, as I understand it. This is based on these parents did a lot and didn't do a lot.
Right. Meanwhile, the Ninth Circuit has upheld California's ban on large capacity ammunition magazines. What did the court say in upholding that ban?
So they really focused on the public safety, and they said that these are laws that have shown to prevent mass shootings, that these are laws, in fact, that if we look at mass shootings, that you do use large capacity ammunition in a lot of those tragedies. This was a divided 7-4 decision. It overturned a lower court decision that I believe we talked about a long time ago now. And they indicated that under the Second Amendment, that it is okay to provide these types of restrictions on gun or on ammunition ownership. Again, not restricting guns that people can own, but this ban on large capacity ammunition.
So is this it, or do you think this will be appealed up to the Supreme Court?
I think I'm old enough to now say it's never it. So we know that there is a New York law that's pending before the Supreme Court this term, where the court is going to look at the contours of the Second Amendment. I think it's first big Second Amendment case in 12 years, and they're going to focus on concealed carry permits. I think that this decision also could be appealed to the Supreme Court because we know that this is a very conservative court. And this is a court, frankly, where a number of the justices have been waiting for more challenges based on the Second Amendment. They've been waiting for challenges based on Roe. We talked about that last week. They've been waiting for challenges based on the Second Amendment. And I expect if it's not this case, it will be another case.
Well, meanwhile, California also has a ban on assault weapons. So could that also be in jeopardy?
Probably not based on the Ninth Circuit. So based on this particular decision by the Ninth Circuit, I think that ban would look like it was upheld. Mm-hmm. But what would happen before the Supreme Court? I'll say let's be circumspect. Let's wait to see what the language is out of that New York case dealing with concealed carry permits. Let's wait to see if they take this current case that we're talking about, and we'll see how far the court wants to go when it comes to expanding Second Amendment rights. Again, I think it's a question of not whether, but how much.
Okay, finally, I want to ask you about another topic, voting rights. The Department of Justice today sued Texas over its new congressional redistricting maps, saying that these maps discriminate against Latino voters, against Black voters, and other minorities. What do you make of this?
Well, it's the Department of Justice using, frankly, one of the only tools left in the toolbox here. So the Supreme Court has said you can't sue based on partisan gerrymandering. You can only sue based on racial gerrymandering. And the Supreme Court has read the Voting Rights Act in a way that a lot of those cases will be difficult. What's noteworthy here is that the Department of Justice is specifically saying we think there was intentional discrimination. That echoes what we saw in the suit regarding Georgia. And we could be seeing a more aggressive tact from the Department of Justice, at least if and until Congress passes any sort of federal legislation in this area.
Jessica Levinson is a Loyola Law School professor and our regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
In one San Francisco restaurant, armed police are not welcome. Last week, the management of Hilda and Jesse asked three armed officers to leave the restaurant, saying their presence and their guns were making their workers uncomfortable. The owners eventually posted about the incident on Instagram. Well, they now have tons of one-star reviews on Yelp and have since issued an apology for handling the situation poorly. Joining us to talk about this story is Dion Lim, reporter and anchor for ABC 7 in the Bay Area. Welcome back to the show, Dion.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
Okay, so tell us about what happens. Three police officers come into this restaurant. They sit down, I guess, and they want a meal. What happens next?
Yes. So a little bit of context of how this all unfolded. I was made aware of the situation on Friday via users on social media, also text messages from sources and people in the community saying, oh my goodness, we witnessed or heard about an incident where three uniformed on-duty police officers were at this restaurant. It's called Hilda and Jesse in the North Beach neighborhood of San Francisco. And when they sat down to be served, they were apparently approached by members of the staff who politely asked them to leave the restaurant. They did offer them some free food, but said they felt uncomfortable with the fact that they were carrying weapons. And that, of course, turned into a social media firestorm, and the story kind of took legs and took off from there.
Well, it became a social media firestorm because they posted about it on Instagram. So why did they do that?
They did. I think it's because they had gotten so much backlash from the community. I mean, like you mentioned on Yelp, the review site, as of today, they had 650 plus negative reviews, one star reviews, to the point where Yelp even had to kick in one of their restrictions. It's a measure that they put in place, banning further reviews when a restaurant or business receives excess media attention, potentially from people who have not actually dined at the establishment. So I think this restaurant had no choice but to put up a statement in response, especially because up until this incident, this was a very popular restaurant. They just opened at the beginning of November. They were on Eater's list of hot restaurants to attend in the month of December. So they had been getting some really good press until a few days ago.
Okay, so I want to play a clip of tape from one of the owners who spoke to you exclusively. Her name is Rachel Silcox, and here is her explanation.
It's not about the fact that we are anti-police. It is about the fact that we do not allow weapons in our restaurant. We were uncomfortable, and so we politely asked them to leave. It has nothing to do with the fact that they were officers and everything to do with the fact that they were carrying guns.
Okay, so I guess they've modified that stance a bit since then.
They have. And I should point out that in asking them these questions, it was a little over an hour before the 11 o'clock newscast that I had to anchor on Saturday. So I was granted this exclusive interview only if I could keep my questions to minimal, to a minimum of two. And I really wanted to get to the point of why their decision was this. Was it because they were anti-police? And clearly, as you heard, they say they are not. And to also provide a little bit more background that I'm not sure if people are aware of, is that Hilda and Jesse, as a restaurant, has billed themselves as an open, inclusive space. They even have an item on their menu called Pancakes Without Borders, an ode to welcoming more toppings on pancakes and having it be a safe space. The owners themselves are in the LGBTQ community. So that came on Saturday night, that interview, and despite it still did not change the court of public opinion. So in turn, they issued an apology late Sunday evening.
And so has that calmed everyone down, or we still don't know yet?
I don't think so, especially given the fact that San Francisco police also issued a statement out on Saturday, basically saying that they were disappointed, they were discouraged. This came directly from the chief. So on weekends, I'll tell you, when we make inquiries about other stories that happen in the city, we don't always get a response back because staff is limited. It's the weekend. So for the chief himself to come out and say something is a pretty big deal. And continually people are weighing in on social media and other platforms. So no, I think the attention is still there.
Well, as they say, all press is good press for businesses, even though they're getting these one-star Yelp reviews. Is this good for their business?
Oh boy, that really is the million-dollar question, isn't it? Look, this has been a restaurant that has received many accolades. There are people in the community who believe that they could even receive awards with the level of brunch that they're serving. However, in this climate right now, especially with the restaurant being so close to a police precinct in the North Beach neighborhood, you have to understand this is a community that has protected its police officers because they currently are eating in their establishments. They're frequently walking the streets. So do I think that they'll survive this? I do, based off of the food itself from the reviews that came in prior, but it is going to take a lot of work. And in their apology, the owners said they wanted to build bridges. They wanted to make this a teachable moment. They admitted that they handled this badly and that they were open to having an open conversation as to what they're going to do with their policy going forward. That has yet to be seen. But I think if they make a concerted effort to show the community that they are inclusive, like they say they are, I don't know. I think they may come out okay after all of this.
Maybe they'll offer a free pancake breakfast to those three officers.
I do believe people have suggested that, yes.
Dionne Lim, reporter and anchor for ABC 7 in the Bay Area. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, there has been a string of high-profile violent crimes in Los Angeles, how that might affect politics and the law here, and the man behind the blockbuster movie Saturday Night Fever.
You recognize that there was some kind of magic going on in those dance scenes for what would turn out to be a very dark movie.
A new documentary looks at how Robert Stigwood changed the movie and the music industries. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A few high-profile crimes in recent weeks have LA retailers and residents on edge. We've seen the videos of smash-and-grab burglaries at high-end stores like Nordstrom and Louis Vuitton, the reports of people being followed home and then robbed, and then last week, the fatal shooting of an 81-year-old philanthropist, Jacqueline Avant, in her Beverly Hills home. Kevin Rector covers the LAPD for the LA Times, and he's written about the recent string of crimes and how they might shape the local and national conversation around criminal justice reform. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Well, overall, what does LAPD data show about what's happening with crime rates here in Los Angeles?
Well, violent crime is up substantially over both last year and even more so over 2019. I think homicides are up more than 45% compared to 2019. Shootings are up more than 50%. Property crime is more of a mixed bag overall. I think it's relatively flat. We've seen an increase in robberies more recently. I think over last year, robberies are up about 2.6% over the same period last year, but they're down 6.6% from 2019. Burglaries are down 8.4% from last year and down 7.7% from 2019. Car thefts are a different story. They're up substantially, I think nearly 53% from 2019.
Wow.
So a bit of a mixed bag on the property side.
Right. But mainly pretty low in comparison to recent years.
Below where things stood in 2019.
Right. Although we're getting a lot of news about these smash and grabs. And I guess is that fueling a kind of anxiety, at least among the merchants, right?
Yeah, you know, it's been a tough road for retailers in the past couple of years, and I think they're counting on this holiday season to help them push on. And there has been some consternation with high profile, pretty brazen crimes in which storefronts have been smashed in, and folks have been allegedly followed from, you know, out being out and about back to their homes with luxury merchandise. So there is some concern and some consternation, like I said, and it's related to these high profile incidents that are happening in some of LA's, you know, most exclusive shopping districts.
And then, of course, there was the killing of Jacqueline Avant, very high profile. Oprah Winfrey tweeted about it, as you report in your story. She said the world is upside down in response to this killing, but. In reality, Beverly Hills is a pretty safe space, a pretty safe city in general, one of the safest in the country, right?
That's true. And that's what police have said as well. Miss Avant's homicide was horrible, of course. It was also an outlier in a city that is very safe, has very few homicides, few robberies. And police have tried to make that point, trying to put the recent incidents in perspective. But when an individual has the prominence of Miss Avant, has the political and entertainment connections that Miss Avant had, you start to see high-profile individuals raising concern about what's going on. And that, of course, is seen by politicians and police leaders as well. And I think that helped translate into a news conference by the mayor and the police chief on Thursday, in which they were addressing some of this crime. It's definitely become, you know, a talking point in LA.
And what are they saying about it?
Well, we've seen their tone shift a bit from where it was after George Floyd's killing in 2020 and the protests that arose in the criminal justice reform movement that gained some strides in recent years. This past week, we saw both Mayor Garcetti and Chief Moore lament the fact that they say repeat offenders are responsible for some of this crime. Chief Moore talked about there having been arrests in a number of these so-called smash and grab incidents, but that those individuals who were arrested were already released. There were concerns raised by both Garcetti and Moore about the zero bail policy that's in place in relation to COVID-19 and it spreading in jail populations and a court decision to try to stem that spread. And so they're starting to talk about their own concerns about what they say are repeat offenders being on the street.
Right. Speaking of repeat offenders, the man who allegedly killed Jacqueline Avant is a repeat offender. What is his story?
So he had been incarcerated for a robbery before. He was on parole at the time he allegedly killed Miss Avant. And he was arrested not by Beverly Hills police initially, but by the LAPD after he was allegedly burglarizing a Hollywood home in the hours after Miss Avant's killing and accidentally and literally shot himself in the foot, which preceded his being arrested by LAPD and then LAPD and Beverly Hills police putting the two cases together. And they say connecting this individual to both crimes through a bunch of different evidence, including the gun that was used.
So what does this all mean for George Gascon, the LA County DA? Apparently, he has been served another recall notice today. And this campaign against him is citing the smash and grabs and the murder of Jacqueline Avant. What is his office saying? What is he saying about all this?
Well, he has been a popular target of folks who think crime is out of control and who cite the increases, particularly in violent crime. Gascon has come in with a progressive reform agenda and made some decisions that have riled folks who think that we should be going in a different direction, namely not using enhancements to go after longer sentences for offenders. And also taking a look at how cases for nonviolent crime are adjudicated or even handled by his office before going to trial. He says that he is working closely with law enforcement to try to address the issue and that he and his prosecutors will do what's in the interest of society to deal with folks who are committing these brazen crimes. But I don't know that the steps his office are taking will please his critics who see him as a major impediment to safety in the streets in LA. And I think that's why they want to recall him.
Kevin Rector covers the LAPD for the LA Times. Kevin, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the packaging of movies and soundtracks became a big deal with the movie Saturday Night Fever, and one man figured that out. His name is Robert Stigwood. We'll talk about a new documentary about him next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Back in 1976, a New York Magazine article about Brooklyn's underground disco scene would inspire one of the most popular films ever made. Stayin' Alive by the Bee Gees, heard in the opening scenes of the 1977 film Saturday Night Fever. That film caused a disco mania throughout the country. The soundtrack sold more than 40 million copies. It went platinum 16 times. And it gave us hits like Night Fever, How Deep Is Your Love, If I Can't Have You. Behind it all was an impresario named Robert Stigwood.
Could I ask, for example, what Saturday Night Fever has grossed thus far?
I think it's around 110 million at the moment in America.
Robert Stigwood was an Australian entrepreneur whose vision for film, music, and theater really changed show business. He helped make John Travolta a household name with Saturday Night Fever and then also with Grease, the movie. He produced the Broadway shows Evita and Jesus Christ Superstar. He was also the manager for Cream, the Bee Gees, and Eric Clapton. For a time in the 1970s, it seemed like everything Robert Stigwood touched turned to gold. Until it didn't. A fierce backlash to disco music eventually capped his career. His story is captured in the new HBO documentary, Mr. Saturday Night. And joining us now is the film's director, John Maggio. Welcome to Press Play, John.
Thank you for having me, Madeline.
Well, great to have you. Well, there are no shortage of characters around the film Saturday Night Fever. Why did you want to focus on Robert Stigwood?
You know, I originally I was very interested in the Bee Gees. And as I started to poke around the Bee Gees stories, I discovered this unbelievable character that I knew nothing about, which is kind of remarkable and says a lot about who Robert was. I mean, he was, to the public, in the closet. He was a closeted gay man in the 60s in London, came to New York and kind of led, you know, he was a different kind of producer, came from the kind of Brian Epstein era, very much in the background, but had his hand in everything. And the more I started to realize that there was this point in the 70s when, as you say, he had the magic touch. He had a vision for where the industry, the music and movie industry, was going before anybody else did, and pioneered the music soundtrack. And so to me, it was a no-brainer, because it also offered me a moment to do a snapshot of the disco era, which I was born in 1970. I had older brothers who used to feather their hair back and wear polyester and go to discos. And so I'd always been sort of fascinated about it. And so it just seemed like he seemed like a perfect sort of vehicle for that kind of storytelling.
Well, let's talk about how Robert Stigwood put this whole thing together, because it really was his vision. He read this article in New York Magazine about the scene in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. And the title of the story was The Tribal Rights of the New Saturday Night. So it was written by this British guy, Nick Cohn, who kind of went in there as an anthropologist to see what these creatures, Italian Americans, were doing on Saturday night, and came away with this article. And Robert Stigwood read it and thought this could make a good movie.
Yeah, he seemed to, you know, it was like he got it right away. You know, just by way of background, Robert had this way. He was a gambler. I mean, he gambled big on a lot of different acts, a lot of things that sort of fell apart, a lot of musicals that didn't quite come together. But when he hit really big. And as we say in the film, he had this kind of sense of smells, as that's kind of how Nick Cohn puts it. And Nick Cohn is a fascinating character. Some consider him sort of father of rock criticism. You know, he very early on in London was covering The Who and Cream and all of those bands. He was almost like an anthropologist, and he'd convinced New York Magazine to let him go into Bay Ridge and kind of poke around and see what was going on in these Italian discos, which was quite different than the sort of gay discos in New York at the time that Nick speaks of. Mm-hmm. And what he found there was, you know, pretty fascinating. It was very tribal, as Italian-Americans in those enclaves are, in Bensonhurst and Bay Ridge. And he discovered a different kind of working class kind of ennui, that sort of, you know, these guys put that all aside for one big night on Saturday night. I think he took a lot of sort of creative license with some of the prose and some of the stories that we sort of learn at the end of my film, that he took more license than we thought. But what he saw
was... Well, he said he made it up, right?
He did.
Pretty much.
Yes, exactly, pretty much. But what he brought to it was a lot of what he had seen covering the mods in London. You know, he kind of had this, he was always interested in sort of teenage culture and the rituals of teenage culture. So he kind of extrapolated from his own youth and brought it to the sort of disco scene in Bay Ridge. But it caught the attention of Robert Stigwood, and Robert Stigwood had this band of very young assistants and things who he tasked with turning this into a movie. I mean, you know, Kevin McCormick, who's a big Hollywood producer now, was like a 21-year-old head of development for Robert Stigwood and had to sort of figure out how to make this move, turn this magazine article into a movie.
Yeah. Well, number one was find a star, and Robert Stigwood saw a young John Travolta on a TV show called Welcome Back, Kotter, and thought, this is my star?
Exactly. I mean, he did. That's what I mean about the vision. He saw Travolta and thought, this guy's going to be a movie star, which was, you know, was kind of unheard of at that time. You know, TV stars didn't become matinee idols overnight. But at that time, it was a huge risk, and he signed for $1 million, which was a huge sum then, for three pictures. He'd already owned the rights to Grease, which was then a kind of 50s musical on Broadway. And he was sort of searching around for the next two. And so when that article came, he thought it would be perfect for John Travolta. And the rest is history.
Well, in a way, it is because he made it so. Because, I mean, a lot of movie studios were like, no, this sounds a little too niche and strange for us. We're going to pass.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple things going on. I mean, by 1975... the year before this article came out, the Hustle had come out, the song The Hustle. Do the hustle. Do the hustle. You know, disco was largely gay, black club music. You know, it was a very sort of niche thing. And when people pegged that song to sort of changing the trajectory of disco and bringing it into the mainstream. So by 1977, as they were making Saturday Night Fever, a lot of people just thought disco was going out of favor, it's been too popularized, people were getting sick of it, and, you know, the disco sucks thing was starting to happen around 77. And what Travolta and Saturday Night Fever and Stigwood did was they transformed that. They gave disco another few years of life, but the studio didn't see it, you know. So when Stigwood was negotiating in 76 and 77, the studio had no concept of what a soundtrack could be. So they didn't get any of the rights. So Stigwood was able to keep all of that money, including 50% of the gross of the film. And so all of the heads of Paramount just didn't get it. And they got it after Saturday Night Fever came out. They, you know, studios, you know, woke up to the idea of owning these soundtracks. But on Saturday Night Fever, they did not see it.
Okay. Well, speaking of disco, let's play a song from the film's soundtrack called Disco Inferno. The boogie starts to explode. That song is so popular. I think anyone listening to that knows this song. It's just incredible. The staying power of that and many of the other songs on that album. So when did Hollywood realize, oh my gosh, we made a huge mistake not getting a piece of this?
Well, what's funny is that another Stigwood innovation was he put that soundtrack out before the movie came out. So he kind of primed the pump. I mean, that soundtrack had already sold millions before any theater had played Saturday Night Fever. So he got everybody excited about it, which, you know, I have to say, you know, I've lived in LA, I've worked in Hollywood, you know, there's very few visionaries. There's very few people that see a hit until 10 people say, I think it's a hit, you know. That's another reason that I think makes Stigwood such a seminal figure, because he could see it, he could feel it in his bones. So, you know, the powers that be at Paramount didn't, but they caught on pretty quickly before the movie even hit theaters. And you should know, I mean, the movie didn't score well in early previews. You know, people were not that excited about the movie. There was something about that alchemy of the soundtrack priming them, and then by the time they got to the movie theater, you know, you recognize that there was some kind of magic going on in those dance scenes for what would turn out to be, you know, I don't know the last time you've seen the movie, but it's a very dark movie.
It really is. I mean, it's really dark.
Yeah.
And it doesn't end happily.
No, it's not a happy movie. It's a very dark movie. But the dancing is what people remember. And that's what's funny about this film is, I think people will go back and watch Saturday Night Fever and be surprised just how dark it is, because what we take away from it is the music and the dancing and all that stuff. But at its core is a sort of you know, a very dark story about yearning and trying to, you know, get out of what was then an Italian sort of, you know, ghetto. Hmm.
So he came up with this idea of using the soundtrack to sell the movie, and it worked. And after that, and he made a ton of money. Did everyone make a lot of money off this?
Actually, yes. I mean, I think there was some dispute between the Bee Gees' ultimate take and what Stigwood got, and I believe there was a lawsuit, even though they remained friendly. I do think there was some lawsuit, but I remember talking to some of the studio engineers, and when one of them, Abby Gallutin, who was the sort of master of some of the tape loops and things that were used on that soundtrack, he got a producer credit on it. I remember him telling me that his first residual check was for $300,000. And wow. He bought a house in the Hollywood Hills at that time that cost, like, I don't know, like $30,000. So, you know, just to put it in perspective, everyone, down to the engineers, made a pretty penny off that, and including Robert, which is, you know, part of the reason he sort of lived in the background was for tax reasons. He got out of the UK and set up a shelter in the islands and lived on his yacht. So he took all those hundreds of millions of dollars and stowed them away in the Bahamas.
And so by the end of the 70s, Robert Stigwood is what, like the most powerful man in Hollywood?
He had the kind of Midas touch. I wouldn't say, I think they were more powerful. He wasn't the player that others were. He just kind of lived in the background. Part of it was, he's a complicated guy. He was an Aussie who I think wanted status in the UK and could kind of realized in his career he couldn't buy that kind of status. You know, it was always about class. He was closeted. I mean, the people who knew him knew he was gay. He was very out. One of the reasons he knew about disco is because he would go to the discos in Rio and in Paris, and that was how he met men. He always had a coterie of young men around him. But he, you know, he felt like he couldn't be quote-unquote out as a gay man. So he lived a lot kind of in the shadows in a very funny way, but he had a very sort of tight-knit group of people that were in his group. So to say, yes, he was very powerful, but he wasn't one of those outsized Hollywood figures, which is interesting. But of course, by the 80s, that magic touch seemed to lose it or lost interest in having big hits. And then he just kind of faded away.
And what was he like as a person? What kind of what was his personality like when he was at the top of his game?
Well, he like I said, he loved excess. He lived incredibly large. We talk about the flower bill at his office in New York was something like $15,000 a week. Just, you know, outsized living. And he spent his money in lavish people, and they would often just take off and go to Rio for the weekend. And he really loved his money. But there's a great moment, I think, at the end of the film where you see Stigwood on this massive yacht, which again, doesn't even seem like a very comfortable. It's so big, it feels almost like a freighter, where he's alone. He's kind of sunburnt, and he's eating some sausages and eggs, a very sort of English meal, and he's got his HP sauce next to him. And I think that at his core, that says so much about him. You know, I've shown this film to some Brits who, you know, it's all about class in Britain. And you see that HP sauce marks you as someone who's not quite there, hasn't quite achieved that kind of British royalty, that kind of British success, even though he hung out with royalty. He's never quite in the club. And I think that always kind of stayed with him. I think that's what motivated him to be a success. And then at the end of his life, I think it was also a little bit of, like, you know, a tinge of sadness to me.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Madeline. It was great.
John Maggio, director of the new HBO documentary, Mr. Saturday Night. The film debuts December 9th on HBO and HBO Max. All right, don't forget you can download or subscribe to our podcast and listen when you want at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. And public service announcement, if you've never had HP sauce, try it. It's delicious. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.